Chapter 21. Koalas are full of chlamydia. So apparently, I'm really leaving for the Australian outback tomorrow, I said to the stormtrooper beside me. His look was one of surprise or horror. Honestly, it's hard to tell what a stormtrooper is thinking, even if you've been married to him for 17 years. I blame the helmet. You can't even find your way around the mall without asking for help, Victor responded with mild disbelief, unconsciously gripping his firearm made of PVC pipe. This whole trip is the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard of. Yeah, you bought a used movie-grade stormtrooper costume so you could join a bunch of strangers who visit sick kids in the hospital, and you don't even like healthy kids. I'm pretty sure you're not in any position to judge what's ridiculous. He shook his head, still baffled that I was going through with this, but he was right. I was fucked. It was Halloween, and I was spending what might be my last night alive in America, chasing after a 9-year-old, sugar-riddled, zombie Red Riding Hood, while my stormtrooper husband hopped through the neighborhood with us. At the last minute, I had surprised him by dressing up as Darth Vader, so that when he was suited up, I could jump up and scream, "Victor, I am your boss!" He was not amused. I tried the death grip, but he refused to lean backward into the invisible choke. It was probably because after I got Victor dressed in his 27-piece outfit, he found that he was unable to sit, lean, bend over, or even put on his own shoes without help. It's really not that different from how most women feel after getting spanked up for date night, but as a man, he was totally out of his element. He was like a knight, but wearing PVC and a unitard instead of a suit of armor. Honestly, if the rebels knew what I knew, they would have just pushed all the stormtroopers over like dominoes, leaving them to awkwardly rock like turtles who've been accidentally rolled over on their backs. I suspect that the stormtroopers' wives, who obviously had to help them completely dress and undress every day, went into their marriage knowing that they were likely going to be young widows. It's sad, but I'm betting the dark side had good life insurance plans. The dark side always seems very organized and sort of vaguely Republican. This whole Australian trip thing had started a month ago when my friend Laura asked if I wanted to come with her on a trip sponsored by the people who want you to go to Australia. I said no, because I am the only person in the world who hates to travel, and because I knew that everything in Australia wants to kill you as violently and painfully as possible. Laura sighed and told me to keep an open mind, and in my defense, it's very hard to keep saying no to the person who once voluntarily chased off vultures with a shovel and helped you dig up a decomposing corpse in the scorching Texas heat of your backyard. I would explain that last sentence, but it's all in my first book. Go buy that and read it. It's probably on sale. I'll wait. Also, pick up some donuts. You look too thin. You should eat something. Are you done? Excellent. Okay, back to the story. This whole Australia thing was a do stuff on your life list event sponsored by Tourism Australia, so we'd get a free trip as long as we wrote about it later. I reminded Laura that the very first thing on my life list is to never write a fucking life list. She then reminded me that I was being cynical again and pointed out that this was basically a free ticket to do anything we wanted as long as it was on our life list. Really? I asked skeptically. Can I box a kangaroo? Laura stared at me. Do you want to box a kangaroo? Well, no, not really, I admitted. But I would like to know that I have the option. Except I don't want any kangaroos to get hurt, so maybe pudding wrestling with kangaroos? Is that a thing? The problem is, she said, I don't think kangaroos are naturally that fighty. No, I replied vehemently. Kangaroos are mean bastards who totally box each other in the wild. If anything, we're making it safer for everyone by putting mittens on their hands. And they also smoke cigars while they're doing it, so they're polluting the environment too. Kangaroos don't give a shit about secondhand smoke. Laura raised an eyebrow. Seriously, I saw it in a cartoon from the 50s. She sighed deeply. Everything you know about Australia, you learned from cartoons. This is exactly why you need to go. Did you know that there's a town in Australia filled with ghosts and possibly lots of serial killers? I perked up. We should go there. Is it on your life list? Well, it is now, I muttered somewhat accusingly. Can we go hold koalas while dressed in full koala costumes? And would you be more likely to say yes if I tell you that I already have the costumes? Laura stared at me. You have two koala costumes? Well, yes, you need a backup in case one's dirty. Laura said, I'm kidding, I said, but I do have one koala costume and one panda costume, and they're both sort of bears, so that should count. Laura didn't respond, but that was probably because she was thinking that koalas aren't actually bears, and technically pandas seem more like giant raccoons than bears, so I suspect she decided just not to bring it up because she's good at picking her battles. Laura suggested that we take a sleeper train through Australia, since I hate to fly, and I grudgingly admitted that I had always wanted to go on the Orient Express, but that I had always sort of considered it a wasted opportunity if a murder didn't happen. It's not that I'm particularly bloodthirsty, it's just that I have standards, and it seems like it's not the full sleeper train experience if there's not a murder provided. I considered that if I wrote it down on my life list, then Australia would be forced to provide a murder for me, but then I worried that they'd be all about enabling and supporting and would instead make me responsible for planning the murder, and I can't even organize my sock drawer, much less a murder. Laura seemed concerned that I was putting too much thought into this possible murder, but I think that's just because she is a professional event planner, and this stuff is second nature to her. Laura needs to realize that not everyone is born with this natural organizational skills that she has. If they were, then there would be festive murders happening all the time, ones with hors d'oeuvres and charitable donations and chocolate fountains and mason jars with paper straws and souvenir bags with human ears in them. Laura looked at me oddly when I said that, but I think that's just because she can't take compliments well, or maybe because human ear party bags are so 2011. I really don't know. I am terrible at keeping up with trends. I said no to Australia about 8 billion times until Laura finally said, "You are always going on about forcing yourself to be furiously happy and pushing past your comfort levels to really live life. Well, this is one of those times, sister, so buckle up, buttercup, and get your work visa." She raised her voice, screaming victoriously and slightly intimidatingly, "We're gonna see the wild side, bitches!" And so I said yes. And Australia said yes. And my therapist said that I would need extra therapy sessions. And the woman scheduling our itinerary said, "I will set everything up and tell you what you're going to be doing less than 12 hours before you actually leave the States." And she did. The trip was to be based on life goals that we wanted to tick off our bucket list. And so Laura and I started putting together goals that we actually wanted to accomplish, but that we'd probably never do if we were paying for it on our own. Mostly because we're cheap bastards and terrible at booking hotels. My original list reads as follows. 1, lick David Tennant's face. 2, ride a golden unicorn. 3, wish for more wishes. Laura pointed out that life lists weren't the same thing as genie wishes and made me start again. So I revised it to ride on camels and watch giant cockroach races and see where The Hobbit was filmed. But Australia was like, "That's New Zealand." Again, New Zealand is not in Australia, so please stop asking. So then I just added, "Put New Zealand inside Australia so I can see hobbits," to my life list. "I think they kind of have to do it now," I explained to Laura. "It's like I'm Alan Rickman in Die Hard and Australia is the baffled hostage negotiator. I think I could probably ask them to bring me a dump truck filled with live slow lorises and a young Sean Connery, and they'd have to do it. I am drunk with power." Laura suspected I was also drunk with wine slushies, and technically, we were both right. I considered that it was entirely possible that this whole setup was a trick, and that I would get there and be forced to spend a week trapped at some sort of terrible timeshare meeting, or maybe it was a sting to arrest me for unpaid parking tickets. But it was also possible that I would be riding camels in Middle Earth, and that seemed worth the risk. After all, it's New Australia. Anything could happen. By the way, New Australia is the name that I made up for when they come to their senses and drop New Zealand into Australia. You're welcome, Australian Tourism Board. I'm giving you that one for free. People warned us that everything in Australia wants to kill you, but I think they're overreacting. Australia doesn't want to kill you. It's more like an exclusive club for people who care very little about being alive. Australia is really a lot like Texas if Texas were mad at you and drunk and maybe had a knife. Like in Australia, they have dangerous funnel web spiders, and in Texas, we have funnel cakes. I don't know what funnel spiders are, but they sound significantly less delicious than fried cake. They're probably equally bad for you, though. People warned us of drop bears, mythical bears that fall out of trees and eat you, and you're supposed to put forks in your hair to scare them away from your head. I'm not sure why Australia feels the need to make up deadly creatures when they're already crawling with them. It's probably to identify the tourists by all the forks in their hair. We do something like that in Texas with snipe hunts, but you usually end up finding something to shoot anyway, so no one's really mad when they find out that snipes are made up. Then again, watching for trees and putting forks in your hair is probably a good thing as it keeps out the flying foxes. Those are real, by the way. Enormous megabats with 5-foot wingspans, which live in the park in Australia and are better named enormous rats with wings that can envelop you. We actually saw some flying foxes around Darling Harbour, which seems an unfortunate name. I don't like a place that randomly gives itself a compliment. A helpful Australian tried to tell me that it was named after a guy whose last name was Darling, but I wasn't having it. "I don't like it," I explained. "It insists on itself." The man nodded noncommittally, deciding it was better not to argue with a strange foreigner dressed in a full-body koala costume because it was cold and she forgot to bring a coat. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Laura and I thought about leaving traps all over Australia, like cardboard boxes propped up by sticks with babies inside of them to see if we could catch dingoes. But then Laura pointed out that it was probably BYOB, bring your own baby. And I never even remembered to pack phone chargers, so we just crossed that one out. We asked if Greg from the Wiggles could drive us around in the big red car, and the Australian Tourism Board seemed a little hesitant. So instead, we decided to make things easier for them by just keeping it simple. Goal number one. Hug a koala while dressed as a koala. I planned to dress as a koala so that koalas would know what it's like to be held by a koala because turnabout is fair play, except, honestly, they probably just want you to put them down. People are constantly picking them up without asking first. Koalas are the new dwarves. Just because they're smaller than you didn't give you the right to pick them up without asking first. But that doesn't mean I don't want to go to a reserve where there are tons of them and rake them up into a pile and jump on them like they're a furry leaf pile. Koalas, that is, not dwarves. Not that I would jump on a pile of koalas or dwarves. Sometimes we're made up from the stuff that we want to do but don't actually follow through on. Like when someone is an asshole and you want to burn down their garage, but then you don't do it because it's illegal and also because you can't find the matches. I'm made from a lot of unfulfilled arson and unjumped on koala piles. I told Laura that I was tempted to make a koala fall in love with me so that I could sneak it back home in my backpack, and then she pointed out that I didn't even bring a backpack. I am a terrible planner. Maybe I should dress like a eucalyptus tree because they really like to hang on them and it'll put them at ease, I said. And then I'll rub Vicks VapoRub all over me because I think menthol and eucalyptus are pretty much the same thing. And then I'll give them menthol cigarettes to smoke. Those fucking koalas are going to love me. Laura agreed. I read that they're all slothy and out of it because the eucalyptus that they eat is full of poisons and so they spend their whole lives trying to digest toxins. They probably do want saving. They eat toxic shit all day. Someone needs to give them a steak to chew on. I agreed. Or a pound cake and a multivitamin. Plus, she said, tons of them have chlamydia. Luckily, koala chlamydia is not contagious to people, though. Huh. Does it feel like human chlamydia? I asked. I don't know. I've never had human chlamydia, she replied. Laura can be a real braggart sometimes. The more I considered it, the more I realized how much I have in common with these koalas. We're both immunocompromised, lightly diseased, exhausted, full of toxins. I am totally a koala. I'm more of a kangaroo, Laura replied after a moment of thought. I'm laid back until you push me a bit too far, and then I will split your stomach open and walk away while you bleed to death. And that's why I keep on your good side, I said. And I'm also a Hufflepuff because I'm lactose intolerant and I get distracted by birds. Laura didn't respond, but in her defense, it was a lot to take in. My hopes of smuggling a live koala out of the country were significantly dampened, though, when it took the koala wranglers 2 weeks just to approve my koala costume because they were afraid that the fleecy costume would terrify and startle the koalas. It finally got approved, but then when we got to the Sydney Zoo, we were told that we were not on the list and we were certainly not going to be holding any of their koalas. It's possible the koala costume threw them off. I explained that we had specifically been told that we could come here and snuggle koalas and that my outfit had been approved weeks in advance, and they looked at me in a way that made me think that they'd called security. I am way too familiar with that look. We pulled out our paperwork, and they sighed in relief when they told us that we had come to the wrong place and that we wanted the Wildlife Sydney Zoo, which is not the same thing as the Sydney Zoo. "Just how many zoos do you people need?" I asked. "They only recently started calling themselves a zoo, so it's kind of confusing to people," the clerk explained. "Catch the bus back and ask the driver to take you to the aquarium." "Awesome," Laura said. "We're going to hold a bunch of aquatic koalas. I didn't even think those existed."
"They don't exist," replied the clerk.
"Great," I replied. "Then we get to hold a bunch of drowned koalas. This isn't quite the day I expected." 30 minutes later, we made it to the right spot and found that the zoo was part of the aquarium and wax museum conglomerate and was nice but fairly tiny compared to the zoo that we had just been thrown out of. We found our way to a koala enclosement. As a side note, spellcheck says koala enclosement isn't a real thing and wants me to change it to koala enslavement. Clearly, spellcheck feels very strongly about koalas in captivity. Victor says it's because enclosement is not a real word, but I just put it in a book, so it's a real word now, Victor. I told the people working there that I was there to hold a koala, and they looked at me as if I said I was there to hack the limbs off tiny babies. Turns out it's been illegal to hold a koala in that particular part of Australia for years, but I wasn't giving up because they had already approved my costume, so they must have known that we were there to nuzzle koalas. They called the management and found out that I was actually only approved to wear the koala costume while staring at the koalas. I tried to politely argue my way into holding them, but they told me that even David Hasselhoff had only been allowed to stand near them, and that's when I gave up, because if the Hoff can't love in a koala, I sure as hell wasn't going to be able to. And I suppose they had a good reason to be protective of their koalas, since clearly someone had given a great number of them chlamydia. But then again, if they're all rampant with chlamydia, it's not like they're going to get more chlamydia. If anything, they should be concerned about their koalas giving me chlamydia. But I was willing to take that chance because I really wanted to say I'd held a koala, and also because I was pretty sure there were shots to cure chlamydia now. Surprisingly, this argument only baffled the koala keepers, but they were very sweet and apologetic for the disappointment, and they did agree to let me go into the enclosure to photobomb a koala dressed as a koala. It's not quite as romantic as I was hoping for, but at least the koala wasn't overly panicked when he saw me. I thought he'd look terrified, but he doesn't. You know why? Because he's fucking asleep. I suspected they were all high on quaaludes, and I was a little jealous. I probably could have drawn a Sharpie mustache on him, and he still would have stayed in whatever crazy fever dream koalas have. I think the lesson here is that you shouldn't get your hopes up about holding koalas, but technically, they smell weird, and tons of them have chlamydia, so maybe this was the universe's way of saving me from myself. Or from chlamydia. As a side note, I have several friends who went to parts of Australia where you can still hold a koala, and they all said that it was very sweet, but that koalas are really heavy and a bit stinkier than you'd expect. They suggested that if you really want to hold a koala but you can't, just get a furry pillowcase and fill it with lightly used cat litter, or tie a bunch of sedated raccoons together, or maybe just hold a dead koala. I probably should have asked, do you guys have any koalas that are already dead from the shock of being cuddled? Because we're fine with that. We're not picky, unlike these fucking koalas. I'm sure that would have gone over well. Now that I think about it, it's possible that the sleeping koalas at the enclosure weren't even sleeping. They were probably taxidermied, and they just hot glued them to a branch. That's probably why you can't even pet them, because hot glue melts in Australia because it's broiling so often, and that's why you can't jostle the dead koalas on trees, because they'll just fall right off the tree, and then the jig is up. Goal number 2, see the world's biggest something. Australia has a love for big things, like the big prawn,
30 feet, or the Big Slurpee, 36 feet. I wanted to see the Big Banana, 43 feet. Laura didn't even know that there was such a thing, but once she heard about it, she wanted to go too. Unfortunately, we were in the wrong part of Australia for most of the big things, but we heard rumors on the internet of a big potato, which would only take us a day to find. So we rented a car so we could drive many, many hours so that we could see Australia's big potato. Except it isn't actually a potato. It's a cement sculpture in the shape of a potato. It's right by the gas station, and when we asked the locals where to find it, they all said, "What, you mean the big turd?" Apparently, it's lovingly referred to as a big turd. A big turd potato. A paturdo. And it was awesome. I'm not even being sarcastic about this. It is enormous, and like 1,000 of me could fit inside of it if it was hollow. It took the two of us working in tandem just to drive to the paturdo because Australia is filled with roundabouts and everyone drives on the wrong side of the road. In the end, we decided to split up the work, and I feverishly watched the GPS yelling, "Left, right, roundabout," while Laura white-knuckledly followed my instructions and glared at people daring to easily drive on the wrong side of the road. Roundabouts presented the most difficulty. Instead of red lights and yield signs, everyone just drives in a circle until they find the place where they want out. I'm sure there have got to be some sort of rules to this, but we didn't know them. And so we would just drive in with our windows down, pointing and screaming, "We're going that way, so please don't hit us," to the people in nearby cars. A pile of dogs could have driven better than us. We never used our blinker properly because in Australia, the knob that you think is going to be your blinker is the knob that turns on the windshield wiper. So we had almost no driving skills and a windshield wiper that was constantly on for no reason at all. I bet rental places in Australia can probably tell when Americans have rented their cars because their windshield wipers always need to be replaced. Additionally, everything is measured in clicks and meters and liters, and neither Laura nor I knew how to convert metric to imperial. So when the GPS would show that we needed to turn in 2 kilometers, I would say, "Be prepared to turn in 2 minutes or 2 hours, I don't know which." Laura looked at me with frustration, but she never learned it either, so she couldn't say much. "There's too much math on this vacation," I complained like a whiny American. "I've gone 39 years without learning the metric system, and I'm not going to pussy out now. If I did, it would be like admitting to Mrs. Johnson that I would have to use this one day." Laura nodded in agreement. "Fuck it," I said. "From now on, I'm just going to measure everything in babies, lengthwise. Everybody knows how long a baby is, so it's totally universal. The math people will probably be mad about having to convert everything, though. This is probably how God felt when people stopped measuring arcs in cubits." "Or measuring arcs at all," Laura replied. We eventually drove into the bush, where we were expected to camp for the night. "This place is very bushy," I said, using words to describe things. "Super bushy," Laura replied. "The bushiest." I felt sure Australia would be grateful they'd sent such wordsmiths on this trip. When we arrived at the campsite, we realized it was less camping and more glamping or glamorous camping. The tent was already set up for us, and there was an outdoor bathtub and mosquito nets. There was also a lodge nearby that offered fancy food, booze, hot tea, plugs to recharge our stuff. We met up with Ben, whose name might actually have been Ben or it might be something else, whose family owned and operated the campground. He had dinner with us. It was avocado ice cream with popcorn and Tabasco sauce soup. This is not a joke, by the way. Laura, on Australian cuisine, there's a lot of weird shit happening here all at once. Me, on the same thing, what is in my mouth? Ben told us about a costume party he had been to last week where he dressed up as a vagina, and the guy who was with him dressed up as tweezers to go with the vagina. And it was then I started to suspect that maybe Ben didn't know how vaginas work. And then he exclaimed, "No, no, wait, not a tweezer, that other thing. A speculum!" And then the other diners jumped a bit and stared at us with jealousy, I suspect. Ben assured us that our fear of sleeping in the bush was unfounded. His exact words were, "No worries, mate, she'll be apples," which is apparently Australian for calm your asses down. I asked if there were any rhinos nearby and explained that everything that I knew about the bush I learned from watching The Gods Must Be Crazy when I was in second grade. Then Ben pointed out that that movie was about the bush of Botswana, so basically everything that I know about Australia is Botswana. We explained that our fear of the bush was primarily of possums because they like to make wigs out of Laura's hair. Ben hesitantly admitted that they might not all be apples because we were assigned to sleep in something called possum tent, but he did assure us that Australia's possums were adorable and not the angry, giant-teethed, hissing menaces that we had in Texas. One caution, though, he said, absolutely no food in your tent because that will attract wild animals. Yes, I paused, but Laura and I are made of meat. Ben assured us that we'd be fine and sweetly added, please don't murder our possums. Ours are well-behaved and won't eat your face off. Ben gave us what he called a torch, but what we call a tiny keychain flashlight that seemed to have a short in it because it kept turning off as Laura and I walked through the dense bush alone and shivering. Then we turned directly onto a path with a giant possum in the middle of it. Laura was so scared, she screamed out, Amanda! Which was weird because who the hell is Amanda? Later, she said she just screamed out a nonsensical phrase made of pure fear and too many vowels, but I suspect she has unresolved issues with this Amanda person. Either way, that's when the flashlight went out and we were stuck in complete darkness with the sound of an animal scurrying either toward us or away from us. Protect your hair, I yelled, and I considered covering her hair with my hands, but I was afraid that she might think that my hands were possums and knife me. Laura is awesome, but she's a bit of a loose cannon when it comes to hair possums, but then the flashlight came back on and the possum was gone. I considered telling Laura that it was probably just a ghost possum, but I worried that might freak her out even more. We finally got to our tent, and we put on the kangaroo and koala costumes that I had packed because it was unexpectedly freezing, and also because we thought if wild animals got in during the night, they'd think that we were one of them and they wouldn't eat us. I am not ashamed to say that at one point, we made Blair Witch-esque videos saying goodbye to our families in case we didn't make it. I am ashamed to say that I tried to distract Laura with tales that I had heard the day before during a dolphin-watching trip. Sadly, all I had really learned is that dolphins are super rapey. True story. I don't know why anyone wants to swim with them. Spellcheck is trying to cover it up by saying that rapey isn't a word, but it totally is. Male dolphins can go into murderous rages out of sexual frustration and will even gang rape female dolphins at times. Laura looked at me like I'd gone insane, and I realized that I had just been talking again about scary Australian animals, but I pointed out it's not as if a land dolphin was going to come accost us in our tents, at least not this far inland. Probably. Please stop talking about rapey dolphins, Laura said. Got it, I replied, changing the subject to something lighter. The dolphin tour also pointed out a private island that no one is allowed to go on because there are penguins there that need to be protected, according to scientists, which seems sort of suspect. Penguins in Australia no one's allowed to see. I think the scientists are lying and just want their own private island. That's probably how the Cullens got theirs. Or maybe just stop talking in general, Laura suggested. And so I did. The next morning, I chased a family of wild kangaroos toward Laura while she was taking a bath outside of our tent. I did this out of friendship. Sometimes you have to explain these things, apparently. Goal number 3. Investigate if Australian toilets really do flush backward. I totally tried this, but all the toilets in Australia are low flow, so basically the water just disappears and then comes back. Sorry if you're disappointed. I assure you, you are not alone. But in a way, that's good, because if toilets really flushed backward, you'd get shot in the face with toilet water every time you flushed, like a violently angry bidet. And also, apparently, Australia thought that this goal was too ludicrous to take seriously, and instead decided to send us to the outback to see more interesting things. We were to be in the outback for several days, which seemed very wild and exciting until I actually read about the outback on the plane ride there and realized it was basically just rocks and desert. It looks a lot like West Texas if West Texas went on for a billion miles and you took out all the beer barns and people and replaced them with deadly snakes that want to murder you. The only real difference between West Texas and the outback is the pride Australians have in their rocks. And they should be proud. There are enormous rocks in Australia, and we were on our way to see the second largest one in the world, Uluru. I saw it as we flew over it toward the airport, which was built specifically to let people fly in and look at a big rock. I turned to Laura. "Hey, there's that big rock," I nodded toward the plane window. Laura leaned over to see it. "Huh, that is a big rock." She nodded somewhat impressively, the same way you would if you saw a monkey do the Macarena on YouTube, and then she flipped desperately through our guidebook to see if there were any bars in the outback. "So now what do we do for the rest of our 3 days here?" I shouldn't have doubted Australia, though, because when we looked closer at our itinerary, we found that we'd be doing a lot in the outback. Like looking at other, almost as big but not quite as big as Uluru rocks, or eating while listening to the rocks, or walking around the rocks, and taking a sunrise tour of the rocks and a separate sunset tour of the rocks, and buying pictures of the rocks. We did not have high hopes for this leg of the journey. I suspected we were being unfair, though, because the guidebooks all said that Uluru was astounding and that the subtle light changes on the rock turned it into a whole new rock each time the sun moved. I assume the people writing those guidebooks were on LSD because I once said the exact same thing about biscuits when I was really high. Turns out that the guidebooks were right. Uluru was pretty amazing. It's the second largest monolith in the world, and I didn't ask what a monolith is, but my guess is it's Latin for big-ass rock. Our hiking guides drove us to Uluru from the resort, which was a small cluster of low-end to high-end hotels that you could stay in if you didn't want to sleep outside and be gnawed on by dingoes. The dingo gnawing wasn't specifically in the hotel and brochures, but I think it was implied. No dingo nibbling here, probably. Running tap water on demand, something like that. The small airport, the resort, and some tents that we never saw were about the only thing for hours, so there was no escape. But we found out that our medium-priced hotel was quite lovely and offered a full bar, so we were fine. Also, the room that we were in had an interesting carpet that was supposed to remind us of ancient red-bottomed creeks, but instead, the blood-colored stain running through the brown carpet looked a lot like a murder victim had been dragged across the room and thrown off the balcony, but in a pretty way. Our guide was a very sweet and knowledgeable woman who was eager to share the cultural magic of Uluru, which is now owned by the Aboriginal people who originally owned it back before white people showed up and said, "You have no concept of ownership? Lovely! We own all of this now, but never mind that. How are you? Can we escort you somewhere else and treat you like shit for a while?" It is a very long and sordid history that is only now beginning to be rectified, including giving Uluru back and paying the local indigenous people to let tourists take place. But it basically boils down to the same principle around the world, which is that white people suck and should not be allowed to discover anything that's already been discovered by the people who've lived there since the world began. On behalf of white people everywhere, I would like to offer an extremely late but completely sincere, I am so very sorry for our being assholes. We're learning. Also, I've heard a few stories about some of you guys eating some of us in Tasmania, but I can assure you there are no hard feelings. We'd probably eat us too if there was enough money in it. I didn't have any pictures of the lovely Aboriginal people that I met because they think it traps their spirit. And if they're correct, then Facebook is basically creating a living hell, which is actually not that surprising now that I say it out loud. Our guide, whom I'll call Jessica because I am a terrible journalist and I don't write down names, drove us, plus an older American couple and a young Danish girl, the short distance to the base of Uluru, where she began explaining that the part of the rock that we see is, quote, just the tip. High five if you giggled there. And that the majority of the rock is still underground. Jessica used a stick to trace out in the red sand what Uluru actually looked like, the long shaft hidden, rising slowly upward until just the tip penetrated the surface. I stared at Laura with wide eyes, and she stared back at me as we realized that our guide had totally inadvertently drawn a penis on the ground that all of us were looking at in amazement. I got a quick photo of it, but it doesn't really show up in black and white. Plus, our guide was in the process of stomping it out. But if you would like to see a color picture of a young woman stomping on a penis on the ground, I can deliver. Not that you would want that. I'd like to think that no one would really want that. We were sent to explore the desert and find out what might want to murder us. And after an hour of heat, we suspected it was Jessica, who kept pointing out new rocks. It was the same rock. I was no fool. Except that I was out in the desert on a forest walk, seeing imaginary snakes at every twig, so all bets were off. I never saw any live snakes, but apparently Australia is lousy with them, and they have so many that even their lizards are snakes. Please note, if you're a lizard but you don't have legs, you're a snake. That's how snakes work. There's even a picture in the book that I took of Burton's snake lizard that says, "This is not a snake, but a harmless, legless lizard. I am not a snake. This snake is a dirty liar." It is never not snake season in Australia. In Texas, in the winter, we at least get a break from the scorpions when they all seem to disappear. I assume they must be hibernating with bears, which is sort of terrifying because imagine waking up a cranky bear and he's dripping with angry scorpions. That would be the worst thing ever. And now that I think about it, it's probably something that totally exists in Australia. Laura and I started our walk around the big rock, and it was quite enjoyable, except for the flies, which followed you in hordes, like an angry entourage intent on setting up house in your nostrils. I just pinched my nose closed at one point, and then I accidentally ate two flies. You'd think that that would teach the other flies to avoid me, but no. These were stupid, reckless flies following stupid, reckless tourists. We pretty much belonged together. Uluru was quite cool. And a bit mysterious. Laura and I both heard chanting, which we assumed was piped in, but which Jessica assured us was all in our heads. She suspected we were drunk. We weren't, but we appreciated the suggestion and quickly located a pub. We found out that getting drunk in Australia is referred to as, quote, putting on the wobbly boot and getting off your face until you do the, quote, technicolor yawn, which I think is the funnest euphemism for vomiting ever. We also learned how to pronounce things with an Australian accent. For example, if you say, good, I, might, it sounds like you're saying, good day, mate. Good, I, might. See? Also, raise up lights sounds like razor blades. Raise up lights. Raise up, yeah, I can't do it. And down under is down under. Basically, you just clench your teeth like you have TMJ and drop a lot of R's haphazardly. Honestly, Australia is just wasting a lot of its R's. It's a little ridiculous. Goal number four, find out if kangaroos really have three vaginas. Did you know that kangaroos have three vaginas? Because they totally do, and that's probably why they're always hitting each other. They probably have PMS every damn day of the week. But on the plus side, kangaroos have plenty of places to smuggle things because they have so many holes in their bodies. In fact, they're so full of holes, it's sort of shocking that all of the kangaroo doesn't just leak out. Interestingly, female kangaroos have three vaginas, but male kangaroos only have a two-pronged penis. It's like they've started a Darwinian game of one-upmanship, and the girls are winning. Fascinating factoid, kangaroos also drool on themselves to keep cool because nothing looks cooler than a drooling kangaroo, apparently. But that's helpful to know because when you see them drooling at the mouth, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have rabies. It just means that they're hot. Hot referring to their temperature, not their sexiness. If you find a drooling kangaroo sexy, you probably need help. I wanted to ask the Wildlife Sydney Zoo about whether kangaroos actually do have three vaginas, but they wouldn't even let me touch their koalas, so I thought a gynecological exam on a kangaroo was probably out of the question. And also, I didn't have my forceps with me. Instead, Laura and I drove into the bush and looked for real, wild kangaroos so that I could peer up their bums when they leaned over. I couldn't see anything through the fur, although one of the kangaroos did get an erection. It was pink and not attractive, at least not to me, but then I'm not a kangaroo. Although I did dress like one to put them at ease. There is actually a picture of me in the book showing a kangaroo a picture of himself. He is unimpressed. Kangaroos don't understand selfies. We also ate kangaroo, which I felt a bit bad about. partially because they're cute and partially because they taste terrible. Well, maybe not terrible, but they taste a lot like blood because if not served very rare, kangaroo is as tough as shoe leather, which always seems a strange analogy to me because when are people eating shoe leather? How do they know what it tastes like? Why don't they say purse leather or pants leather? Anyway, Australia is a very strange country because you spend days running around trying to find wild kangaroos so you can see their majesty, and then you eat them on a pizza an hour later. Bloody, vampire-friendly pizza. People in Australia really seem to like kangaroo meat, but the only time I ever had it and didn't hate it was when it was sliced really thin and then drizzled in something alcoholic. And I think I only liked it more then because there was so much less of it than usual. If they had sliced it so thin that I could read through it, I suspect I would have liked it even more, and I probably would have even asked for seconds if they just waved a fork of kangaroo juice near my lips. Or maybe not. I'm not much of a foodie. Goal number 5, boomerang. We had the opportunity to learn to throw spears in the outback, but it was always scheduled right after we'd been drinking. Technically, everything was scheduled right after we'd been drinking, but it was the outback. There's not a lot to do other than just get drunk. I tried a plastic boomerang that was sitting in a bin outside the gift shop, but it failed to return, and then I realized that I had basically just tossed unpaid merchandise as far as I could throw it. I considered going to get it, but then I was concerned that when I picked it up, it would be considered shoplifting, and it seemed like that would have a stiffer penalty than just throwing merchandise into the desert. So instead, I went inside the gift shop to see if anyone would say anything to me. No one did. Probably because it happens all the time. You can't just leave boomerangs out in the open and expect people not to throw them. It's like Australian entrapment. I thought about paying for the boomerang, but then I considered that it didn't come back when I threw it, so it was probably broken anyway. If anything, I was doing unpaid boomerang testing. Laura didn't entirely agree and thought perhaps my technique was bad, but she'd been in the bathroom at the time, so she wasn't really allowed to judge. Honestly, I said, boomerangs are made to make people feel inadequate and unloved. They're supposed to come back, but they never do. Boomerangs are like bad, disloyal dogs or hot ex-boyfriends who your mom assures you will return after they've realized they've made a terrible mistake in leaving you, but they totally don't. I'm pretty sure boomerangs work, Laura said. I've seen them on TV. Well, yes, and I've seen cartoon cats eat an entire pan of lasagna in one bite, but that doesn't mean you wouldn't kill a real-life cat if you force-fed him that much cheese. Trust me, Laura, boomerangs don't work unless you throw them up. Laura stared at me. Well, there's your problem. No, I mean in the air, not vomit them up, I explained. Ah, she nodded. I was wondering how that would help. Everything is a boomerang if you throw it straight up in the air, I explained. Not blimps, she countered, with a surprising speed considering the number of drinks she'd had. Touché, I replied. I always forget blimps. Goal number 6, just get out of the damn house. This sounds absolutely ridiculous. However, leaving my house was the hardest single thing of the entire weird trip. For someone who stays home for weeks at a time and struggles to even have a conversation with the UPS guy, saying yes to leaving my safe place was an achievement. And it was worth it. Sometimes you have to force yourself to leave your house, even though every introverted bone in your body wants to secede and make you into a human jellyfish. But I pushed through. And it was amazing and horrifying and back to amazing and weird and baffling and fantastic. We saw dangerous blowholes and hopped with wallabies down the beach and played in tide pools and learned Aboriginal dot painting in the outback and snuggled with camels in the desert. And then we watched 6 Shakespearean actors simultaneously vomit on stage at the Sydney Opera House. It was on the small stage, though. It was only like 300 babies long. And it was good. But I still want to lick David Tennant's face. Get to work on that, England. Australia's in the lead here. Chapter 22, Voodoo Vagina. Last week, my friend Kim mailed me one of her homemade, educational, felted vaginas with a small felted baby inside of it so children can understand where babies come from. And my first thought was that I no longer wanted to understand where babies come from. And my second thought was, wait, Is this pubic hair real? Because if it is, I think I need to wash my hands. And also, isn't this how voodoo dolls are made? I think if you add human hair to a doll, it becomes a voodoo doll. So logically, wouldn't that make this a voodoo vagina? What is even happening here? I left the vagina on my desk while I went to go get my camera to take a picture of it because no one would ever believe that I had gotten a voodoo vagina in the mail and they'd be all, pictures or it didn't happen. But when I got back to my desk, my vagina was missing. I mean, not my vagina, the gifted vagina. Not that my vagina isn't gifted. It's fine. This isn't a contest. I was instantly reminded of a story I heard when I was little about a severed human hand that came to life and gave you wishes but murdered people while doing it. I always thought that there could be nothing creepier than a severed hand running around the neighborhood murdering people until I was faced with the notion that a lone voodoo vagina was skittering around my house. Except that the vagina was oval-shaped and had no fingers, so it'd have to roll, I guess, which made it slightly less creepy, but only slightly. And then I remembered that Haley was home, and I didn't want her to find a random voodoo vagina lying in wait because I'm a good mother. So I had to ask Victor for help because, quote, someone sent me a vagina in the mail, but it wandered off when I went to go get the camera, and it might be on a murderous rampage now. He assumed I'd been drinking, but probably just because he knows how hard it is for me to ask for help. I clarified that it was an arts and crafts vagina designed to show how babies are born, but that I think it did have real pubic hair on it, and that's why it probably came to life and ran away before I could photograph my friend's vagina. And then Victor shook his head, but instead of shutting his door, he came out and helped me go vagina hunting, because honestly, when else are you going to have the opportunity to do that? 15 minutes later, we discovered the missing vagina halfway up the stairs where the cat was chewing on it. I was a little grossed out, but more just concerned about my friend because if it was a voodoo vagina, she had probably just fallen crotch first into a chipper shredder. I had a closer look and realized that it was the plastic doll hair that you can buy in bags from craft stores, and I felt a bit relieved, but Victor said that I couldn't keep the vagina even if it wasn't made from pubic hair. This seemed like a waste of a perfectly good vagina, but then I noticed that the cat had already torn it up quite a bit and had gnawed off the felt baby's head, so I figured it was a lost cause. I was worried that the cat had eaten the baby's head and would have a digestive block, but then later we found the head in the toilet. It wasn't really a surprise because that cat loves to carry small things around and then drop them into the toilet. Cat toys, Polly Pockets, Barbie doll heads, lipsticks, they all end up in the toilet if you don't keep the lid down. It's like her own personal wishing well. I have no idea what the hell she thought she was going to get in return for a baby's head she'd ripped out of a vagina, but regardless, she seemed optimistic and mewled sweetly, rubbing against my leg as I peered down into the toilet. I flushed, delivering her small sacrifice to whatever toilet god she was praying to. God knows what she wished for. Probably more felt vaginas. P.S. For some reason, people seem to leave this chapter with more questions than they had before they started, so let me reiterate that Kim makes these felt, baby-filled vaginas as an educational tool for young children. She calls them beaver babies, and they now feature, quote, new and improved pubic hair. You can also use them as really gross wallets if you want people to never steal change from you. P.P.S. I didn't make a single pussy joke in this entire chapter. Someone get me a damn medal. Chapter 23. The world needs to go on a diet. Literally. Yesterday, my doctor said that I needed to lose about 20 pounds to be at, quote, a healthy weight. And I really didn't appreciate it because I'd already had quite enough fat shaming from a dressing room that week. This sounds ridiculous, unless you're a woman, and then you're probably nodding because you know the struggle. All dressing rooms are just small cubes of vulnerability with mirrors to help multiply the shame. The worst dressing rooms are the ones that are missing doors for some reason. It's like a nightmare, but real. There was this store in the mall when I was in junior high, back before malls got all sad and dangerous, that had open, non-doored dressing stalls that were located all around the edge of the room with this big empty square in the middle so that every other person in the dressing room could witness you not realizing that there was a zipper or see you with a dress stuck over your head or sweatily struggling to pull on a pair of too small pants over your hips as you heard that unfortunate ripping sound and hoped that people thought it was just gas. Even in regular private dressing rooms, clerks inevitably come to your door right when you are at your most entangled in something and say, "Can I help?" And you say, "No, doing great," in that shaky, high, fake voice that you hope says that you totally don't have a shirt stuck around your shoulders. And you know that the sales clerks are probably watching you on camera and know that you're stuck, which makes it even more embarrassing. My guess is that several stores probably have entire blooper reels of me falling and breaking things. I feel almost as bad when I take 8 things into a fitting room and none of them fit, but I don't want to tell the fitting room attendant that because none of these works feels like code for, "Sorry, I'm fatter than I thought I was." Instead, I give her all but one outfit, which I then put back myself when no one is looking. Because apparently, the opinion of a total stranger who hands plastic numbers to people all day matters to me. I've tried saying, "These didn't work for me," because then it's like you're putting the blame back on the clothes. Like, these clothes weren't even trying. But the downside is that the clerk might offer to help, and that's worse, because then they start bringing you stuff they think that you'd like, and it's never the right size. And by not buying the clothes that they suggested, it's like you're rejecting them too. It's better, though, than those stores that only go up to a size 10, and I just have to pretend I came in to look at scarves and jewelry with all the other curvy women who feel insulted too. Usually, it's only an accidental insulting, but sometimes it's intentional. Like the time that the clerk looked at me like I was the Michelin man and said, "I don't think we carry your size." It felt shitty and pretty woman-esque, so I explained that I was just there to buy clothes for stray homeless dogs because I like to put them in outfits that are worn but not nice enough to steal from a dog, and that shut her right the hell up. I try to love myself exactly the way I am, but it is hard not to feel a bit crappy when your doctor is focused on health and all that bullshit. And yes, I might be slightly overweight, but I'm pretty sure this isn't technically my fault. It's the world's fault. Technically, if I were further away from the center of the earth, then I would be subjected to less gravity, and then I would weigh less. So I'm not really fat. I'm just not high enough. Victor says I sound pretty high already, but I suspect he's just being insulting. But the simple fact is, there's no such thing as real weight, only mass. Weight depends entirely upon the gravity of wherever you are, which is why if you weigh yourself on the top of Mount Everest, you would be closer to outer space and you would weigh slightly less than you would at home. But you would have to lug a scale up to the top of Mount Everest to prove it, which would suck. Honestly, they should just leave a scale up there for people. Although they might already have one, because who's going to drag a scale back down Mount Everest? That would be crazy. Frankly, I never understood why people climb that thing in the first place. But if there's a scale up there telling you that you're skinnier than you think you are, I guess I can see the draw. I'd hike up a mountain, well, helicopter up a mountain for a scale that says I need to eat more, or for a magic bean that turns me into Jennifer Lawrence, or for a nice basket of cheeses, preferably cheddars. Regardless, on the moon, I weigh about as much as a large toaster. So using that logic, I'm not overweight. I am simply over-gravitated. Spellcheck says that I can't be over-gravitated because that isn't a real word and suggested that I probably meant to say that I'm overly aggravating. Victor says Spellcheck has a point. Spellcheck and Victor are both dead to me. Perhaps if people are so concerned with obesity, they should just work on making the Earth have less mass so there's less gravity. I need to go on a diet, Dr. Riker? I don't think so. I think maybe the fucking planet needs to go on a diet. Victor says that this is a clear case of deflection, and I agree, because I assume deflection is something scientific used to deflect mass from the Earth, thus making us all lighter. Victor says he thinks I don't know what deflection means. I think Victor doesn't know what being supportive means. It means letting me lean on him a little when I'm standing on the bathroom scale. I think this is all pretty common sense. Victor says it's not at all. Fuck it. Someone get me a scale. And a mountain. And a helicopter. And some cheeses. Chapter 24. Crazy like a reverse fox. The one billionth argument I had with Victor this week. Victor accused me of being insane, but really, I'm crazy like a fox, but a crazy fox. Not a normal fox that acts crazy, but really isn't. Victor says that the whole point of the phrase crazy like a fox is pointing out that foxes aren't crazy, but I explained that I'm like a reverse fox. People think I'm crazy, but then they realize it's all just a game and I'm super clever. And then they spend a little more time with me and they realize that no, I'm just crazy. But I'm also really lucky because shit still seems to work out for me. I'm crazy like a fox that has really gone insane. And those are the most dangerous foxen. I don't think you're listening to me, he said. And then he said something else, but I didn't hear it because I was too busy being mad about his accusations. I mean, can you believe this guy? And then I realized that he'd stopped talking and was waiting for a response, and I assumed he must have apologized. So I said, I forgive you, but don't let it happen again. And then he yelled some more, probably because he wasn't used to someone being that gracious. He seemed confused, and in my experience, that always makes a man angry at himself. Some men are like dormant volcanoes, always ready to explode with anger, and also always ready to ejaculate everywhere with little warning. Plus, they're often crusty. Metaphorically, I mean. You don't want a man who is literally crusty ejaculating on you. That would be a safety hazard and is probably how the plague is spread. But my original point is that some seemingly quiet men anger easily. Sorry, that metaphor got away from me a bit. I would fix it, but this is what editors are for. Winner, everyone who isn't my editor. And also Foxen, because no one knows what the hell is going on with them, so no one expects anything special from them. Lucky little bastards. Chapter 25. An essay on parsley, wasabi, cream cheese, and soup. As a side note, I had writer's block, so I got very drunk, and when I sobered up, I found that I had written an essay on parsley, wasabi, cream cheese, and soup. I assure you, I was just as bewildered as you, but I decided to leave it in because at this point, drunk me writes much better than sober me. She is such an asshole. Parsley. I'm not a fan. No one ever really eats it, and it just ends up on plates as sort of a symbolic bookmark that says that you're going to pay 25% more for this meal than expected. I don't even think it's edible, and I'm pretty sure melted parsley is how plastic is made. In fact, I suspect that there are actually no more than 1,000 pieces of parsley in the world, and that chefs just keep reusing them over and over. Maybe it keeps showing up on our plates because we don't eat it. Perhaps chefs are continuing to serve it night after night as punishment, much like when your mom served you the reheated lima beans that you refused to eat for 3 straight evenings until you finally forced them down and then vomited onto your plate, ruining lima beans for everyone in the vicinity. It's not our fault, though. From our earliest night out, we're taught 2 things. That's butter, not ice cream, and that's parsley. Don't eat it. Although now that I think about it, you hardly ever see parsley anymore. Maybe it's because we eat less American food nowadays. Instead, parsley has been replaced by that huge mound of wasabi served with the tiniest sushi roll. Wasabi. You never finish it. No one ever finishes it. Have you ever seen anyone ask for a refill on wasabi? No. It always ends up back in the kitchen with the chef, where he probably just adds it back to the huge Play-Doh ball on the counter. It's probably made of parsley. Cream cheese. If cream cheese is cream made of cheese, then why isn't face cream made out of face? Or wait, maybe it is. Maybe I'm just slathering new bits of face skin into my wrinkles, which is pretty brilliant. They probably get the skin from those microdermabrasion places and recycled Biore skin strips. What a bunch of tricky bastards, stripping off your own skin and then selling it back to us. It's almost as insulting as pulling fat out of your ass and then injecting it into your lips, which is totally a real thing that exists and is a pretty good sign that civilization is collapsing. This is exactly why I'm not a fan of forced kissing of your great aunt. You might be literally kissing her ass. Sort of. I'm not really sure what literally means in this scenario. Is it still literally your ass if your ass is in your lips? These are the things they never teach you at journalism school. Soup. I once went to a dinner party where waiters walked around with canapés, which I think is French for hors d'oeuvres, which is also French now that I think about it. Apparently, the French are really into small food, which sort of makes sense because they're all very thin. That girl in Amelie is so tiny, I could fit her in my vagina. Not that I would. I would have said pocket, but I don't have any pockets in this dress. But I do have a vagina, and that's sort of like a pocket, although not one you should store paper money in. Or coins, probably. I guess it depends on how strong your vaginal muscles are. More power to you if you can keep a roll of nickels up there. My hat is off to you, my friend. But enough about your braggy, powerful vagina. I was talking about canapés. I can never eat them because I'm dangerously lactose intolerant, and I'm always afraid there will be some sort of heavy cream hidden in there that will send me to the hospital. But what sucks is that the waiters keep walking around asking you over and over if you want a canapé now, even though you just said 2 minutes ago, I can't eat them. And now it's like they're just taunting me with food I can't have. I recently fixed this problem, though, because I realized that the secret to not having to continually say no to delicious food is to loudly say, "No, sorry, I can't eat that because diarrhea." It is jarring for the people around you, but I've found that most waiters continually ask if you want food, not because they really want you to eat, but because they've zoned out or they're high. I'm basing that one on my personal experience in food service, so stop judging me, unless you're judging me for being high, in which case, fair game. And they have already forgotten who said no. But no one forgets diarrhea. Because diarrhea will make all waiters perk up and avoid you completely. So will a lot of the people at the dinner party. But those are the risks of diarrhea. One time I was at a patio party where I heard that they were handing out soup as an hors d'oeuvre, and I wondered how that was even possible. And then I saw that the waiters were walking around handing out large flat-bottomed spoons filled with a single bite of soup. Personally, I think that whole concept is kind of fucked up regardless of who you are and what you're allergic to. Soup given to you one spoonful at a time by people in fancy tuxedos is pretty much the definition of overprivileged what the fuckery. And I'm pretty sure it was invented by intoxicated food service people who thought it would be funny to see if people would actually fall for such shenanigans. I suspect the next step is crackers that have been pre-moistened by your waiter's saliva and then fed to you from his mouth into yours like you're a baby bird. In fact, by the time that this book is out, spit crackers will probably be the next big thing, and I want it noted that I called it. And it wasn't even warm soup they were serving. It was gazpacho, which I tried once, and is basically what you call tomato soup once it's gone so cold that you just give up and try to pass it off as a non-alcoholic tomato Bellini or like a melty soup popsicle, a soupsicle. Still, everyone at the party tried it because no one wants to admit that gazpacho tastes like partially melted tomato ice cream. The problem was that by the time they swallowed their spoonful of soupsicle, the waiter was gone, causing all of them to stand in their elegant attire while awkwardly holding a dirty spoon like a terrible unwanted accessory. Some people laid their empty spoons on windowsills or on the ground when they thought no one was looking, but most just looked with quiet desperation for a waiter who might never return and were forced to hold the spoon at their sides, seemingly pretending that the spoons were cigarettes or small fancy dogs. I saw one woman look around expectantly for a minute, and when she realized no one was coming back for the spoon, she just shrugged and tossed it in the pool. It seemed slightly bitchy, but you have to respect that level of I have no fucks left to give about silverware that doesn't even belong to me. With that one spoon drop, she told everyone at the party, if you aren't going to take care of your shit, then I'm sure as hell not going to take responsibility for it. And that's when I decided that I adored that woman and her attitude. I would probably feel differently if I was a foundling left on her doorstep, but I was not. I was a woman who had just seen another woman pass the spoon test, a test I didn't even know existed and that no one else had studied for. And it was then that I vowed to never take personal responsibility for other people's spoons, attitudes, stupidity, because frankly, I have enough to worry about with my own shit. I suspect this is one of those life lessons that no one ever gets to really use, but still, I'm ready. Just you try to hand me a spoon. P.S. I just read my friend Karen this chapter, and she liked it very much, but she interrupted me at one point and said, "Hang on, you can't say that you would put the girl from Emily in your vagina." And I said, "I agree. I said I could, not that I would. She would suffocate in there, and she's France's national treasure." And then Karen said, "You need to take out the vagina." And I was all, "In public? I almost never take out my vagina in public. Are you drunk right now?" And then she said, "Ginny, seriously, you have to cut out your vagina part." And I flinched a little at her wording, but then she explained that I should take out the vaginas because men read my books too. And I said, "Karen, men love vaginas. They can't get enough of them. And even men who don't prefer them came from them. Vaginas are like home, a sort of clammy one." And then she flinched at my phrasing and pointed out that not all men love vagina stories and that her father was going to read this book and might get a little offended. And so I told her that I would add a small note apologizing to her father for my vagina. It is shocking how often I have to do this. I suspect it's just one of those things writers have to get used to. P.P.S. I am so, so sorry about my vagina. It is weird how often I have to say that. Honestly, I should just put it on a t-shirt.